będzie na to mowa.
Oh yeah, you should see the stuff he does. 43 passing unit tests. They all say he does nothing.
I say it does nothing.
Hey guys, thanks for the
We're just gonna stand on Harry's.
Okay, welcome back for the first talk in this afternoon session on the development track. We have one of the KD old-timers, Harry Korn, who's not only cool because he has Finnish ancestors, but he also wrote the first implementation of Still the Maintainer of KPPP, and he also wrote the JavaScript code, the KD that is used in Concord, among other things. And Harry will talk about object tree balance.
Good afternoon from me as well. First of all, sorry for not being able to. I badly need a new laptop. This one didn't have a partition big enough to hold KDE anymore. So I had to use a competing product, but I hope that this soon will be over. The topic that I've chosen might have been a bit misleading word-wise, and it might be that even after my talk you will not know what object prevalence is, and still not so sure about it either. It's just a phrase coined by the author of the framework that I'm going to represent, and I will give you a short overview of what I'm going to talk else. But first, depict the motivation of why I have chosen this topic for myself in this conference. You know, we'll talk a bit about object databases, the way we interact with them, and then this object prevalence system that's called Prevailer. It's a trademark term by the author's company. And since this system is written in Java, I'll look at how Java does this work that we're going to talk about, which is basically persistence of objects. And then I'll look at how one could possibly achieve the same in C++. At the end, if there's still some time, I'll maybe shortly bring up another framework that exists in some time, and that is Naked Objects. So the reason for me to start on this topic was that our very little company, of course, needed software to manage data of our customers as well. Mostly it was about licensing management. And we, of course, couldn't afford any commercially available system. It will also be very hard to get anything that runs on several platforms. As we found out, most of the systems actually are web-based these days, something we just decided against by principle. And of course, there's, as a programmer, none of these systems is ever making you really happy because you cannot customize them as you like. I thought if we would implement such a system for us, it would be nice to maybe come up with a generic framework as a result of that that could be useful to others as well. And I'm not talking about a ready-made system that every company in the world could just buy and use for them, or were open source, take it, because I think this is too unrealistic, as a lot of customization will always be I need it. So I'm just thinking of a framework that still has to be adapted by developers. We actually started out by purchasing repo licenses, wanted to be good boys, support them, but in the end we dropped using that product. I think it was mostly because there were too many different technologies inside. It is customizable by Python, I think, and we wanted to stick by C++ because we are C++ programmers. So this was my main motivation, do as much as possible in C++. No built-in macro language of the tool, no SQL statements, and of course no other language as well. The whole system should be simple because I didn't want our company to go bankrupt before we are finished. And the fast is not the execution speed I'm talking about, it's just the fast development. And that, I have to admit, is of course a goal that I already failed, because I've been doing so much research and experimentation that the system is not there, while Reggie might have developed it in his ordinary hacking style several months ago already, maybe. And of course I just wanted to try something new out that would be a bit challenging. The way I got into this object prevalence topic was that I read an article in the German IX magazine. It was called ACID for Free, it's the database principle I will shortly mention later. That got me into researching a bit on the web. Later I learned about that naked object system as well, and those two can be easily combined. After I did some stuff, I discovered that the Russian has already done some implementations that I found pretty amazing. It was probably already too late for me, but it was good that somebody has done real work on such a system already. Now to the topic of object-oriented databases. My talk is not going to be about them, but it's worth visiting them at this point. I found those points at the site that is about object-oriented databases, and it lists a few myths of that system. And my talk is not going to be about saying that those are not true. I guess that many of them are probably actually true, like having a steep learning curve or having problems with queries. It's just that object-oriented databases still have a lot to fight against regular databases. Because the real truth about probably everybody knows about who has looked into this topic is that all the promises that have been made about an object-oriented database simply have not been fulfilled yet. I think this trend probably started about 20 years ago, but there's still no takeoff of the technology yet. I found some numbers, and from that I calculated approximately that object-oriented databases only make 2% of worldwide sales of such systems. And this is, of course, such a small number that it will simply be hard to penetrate the whole market. And one factor contributing to that is that there simply is no good standard yet. Of course, there are standards, like by the ODNG group, but those standards are either not fully implemented yet or not used. But I will, in all fairness, mention the strengths that are supposed to be present in those database systems. The first one, which is pretty important for us, I guess, is that it simply feels more natural dealing with an object-oriented database, since we all do object-oriented programming all day. So the mapping of objects into a relational database is, of course, something that feels foreign to us in some ways. You'll find all the object-oriented properties in those databases as well. You can have your encapsulation, you can have objects inheriting from each other, and virtual functions and everything. Those databases can be very efficient. This is mostly because the conversion of data that's stored in the database to the object that the end user uses is either not there or almost not there. And there's also the possibility that the database transparently caches the objects that it retrieved from the database for the user. So it's actually already constructed and ready to use. And if such a caching system is in place, then you can store and retrieve pretty complex objects in a very, very fast manner from the object database. There's one property that can be used, and that is the versioning. And I guess this is done by also having a unique identifier in each object so that you can track the changes that have been that an object has undergone in the database. And this is then also very important in some niches like CD applications where you have pretty complex objects. Imagine a car with four wheels, and the wheels has of course some subcomponents again. If you have this structure, it's very natural, and to map such a complex system in a relational database will require you to have a lot of tables and a lot of unique IDs to map between those tables again. But the weaknesses certainly shouldn't be left out, and that is that it's simply hard to program with some of those systems. First, there was no query language at all. Then they slowly popped up. There was even a standard. There's even a standard for that, similar to SQL, that is called OQL. But learning SQL is one thing, but learning such an object-oriented query language is another, because the syntax is definitely not that easy to understand sometimes. But since I already mentioned that no vendor really gained market penetration, it's simply a very high risk for anybody to jump on an object-oriented database these days, because with a product that hasn't reached a critical mass, it's simply financial risk. And of course every database has a lot of tools around it to design the data that's in there, to browse the data, to print out reports, and that's something where object-oriented databases have been missing a lot. And since the setup is much more complicated for object-oriented databases, the lack of those tools made it very hard for users to actually use them. And what then happened is that simply the vendors of relational databases came up with a hybrid solution, and basically the response to the object-oriented system. And this hybrid solution that has the relational database as a base and puts through mapping an object orientation on top, it has proven so effectively that with the market size that the old vendors have, they have managed to make it even harder for vendors of those pure object system to get into the market at all. If there is somebody who has studied computer science and or has followed this market and wants to share anything on what I'm saying there, feel free to do so. Independent of what database is behind such a system that I want to design to store my customers' licenses, expiry dates of licenses, employees, if there are any salaries, I still have to interface with the data that's in there. And that's an area where I also wanted the greatest convenience. So I looked at the different ways to interface with a database. There's of course the traditional SQL language that can also be embedded into the code. You can show it later. If you have a higher generation language, you have those statements already built into your programming language, which makes it feel much more natural. But of course we are almost all programming C++, so this is sort of question. The database management group has defined standard bindings in their implementations for C++ and Java. And there is, of course, a standard that has been brought out by Sun, and that is JDA. I'll present those shortly. The possibility to embed SQL statements into your code is, of course, very convenient. For normal SQL, there's also an ANSI standard. And those statements can be put into your code by prefixing them with an exec SQL statement, with a statement following. And this code then can be pre-processed to other C or C++ code and then be compiled. I don't know how many implementations exist, but there's at least one for the LATIC database, which I think is Postgres, and that is ECPG, and that can be run to pre-process embedded SQL. I'll show an example which already turned me off very much, you know, not to follow this direction anymore. It starts out with a declaration block of variables that I'm later going to use in my SQL statements. That's taken from SQL, so if that were done in C++, it might be a bit nicer. And then I've written down three sample statements, one that connects to a database, one that makes a selection, and one that prepares a query. And you can see those DB name and the string that have been declared up there in there. The problem with that is that there's still no natural mapping between the objects that you use in your C++ code and that is in the database. A bit nicer, maybe, although maybe confusing at the first sight, is an example from those C++ bindings to object-oriented databases. It starts out with a OQL query, almost looks like normal SQL. And then through templates, there are possibilities to have references to objects, to have collections, and to have iterators on that object and iterate over those objects rather naturally as if they were in C++ objects. This, of course, possibly hides a lot of complexity that's happening behind the scenes. Because this says nothing about how the objects are really stored into the database. It could still be flat files or a relational database, and there could be possibly a lot of conversions happening behind the scenes, and this conversion sometimes can be a big performance factor, also called the impedance match, because simply the type systems can often not match. So from looking what's available, I defined a bit clearer goals of what I wanted to have for my perfect CRM system. And this would be that I want to have a transparent, persistent system. One that, I have a picture about that, simply displays the objects that are stored in the database to me as the application programmer in a natural manner, as if they were really there and I don't have to care how they get into the database and possibly how locking is done between other users, what happens if there's a crash, how do I do a rollback if something went wrong. I didn't want to use any of those languages like SQL. I wanted to naturally work with those objects as I would do with any other in-process normal temporary objects in C++. I want to use iterators, I want to store them in lists, I want to use STL algorithms on them, etc. Same with manipulations, I don't want to execute any statements, convert types from the native database types to my types, or just fire off a query and see what happens. I want to take an object or implement an object's method, manipulate its members, or invoke a function on an object like if it were any other C++ object. And this then should then hopefully result in a very simple code that I as a C programmer can easily read. And since the system is transparent, I also hope that there should be less code actually. But what this diagram also showed, I mentioned before, is the idea of caching. And that is that the real objects, the unique source, is in the database, of course, but there could be a mirrored instance of those objects in my applications. And there could be even many users in the same network that also have mirrored objects. And the job of the database, of course, is to make sure, or of the systems to make sure, that we don't accidentally override our changes. Or if my machine crashes, that of course, the server still stores the latest version. And now to the system that gave this talk its topic, and is called prevailer. I actually don't know what's the best translation of prevail in German or in other languages, like dominant. It's at least the focus is really to have objects being in the center of this whole architecture and have a persistence layer, which is still a common term, and together with all those other components of this system, the guy Klaus Wüstefeld, that's the author, coined the term prevailer. He has a bit provocative statement, and that is, do you still use a database? I think he probably has some bad feelings about them, and as usual with such technologies, there are many hard feelings involved as well. And the question is whether this is still a database. It certainly misses some components, but it's not that far away from one. Okay, so the components are a persistence layer, that it has a rather lightweight implementation. I don't know, it's just a few hundred lines of Java code, which is really impressive. But of course it makes sense of a lot of powerful Java libraries that are available. It does really fast lookups and manipulations. Since I didn't really do any comparisons myself, I have to give the numbers, which would be a few thousand times faster than some other commercial databases. I take them with a grain of salt. It of course very much depends on the use cases. It fulfills the ACID requirements that I'll explain shortly. It allows replication of databases. You can distribute the data on the fly while it's running to other systems, make backups, do some experiments with it, just for security reasons. And of course, there's an Eclipse plugin meanwhile. Not exactly sure what it does. Unfortunately, I'm missing all the talk that's taking place in parallel. The properties that the system has are pretty, it's a pretty standard model that's been there probably forever in the database science, which is a must for any database that's to be used in a commercial environment, because it guarantees a few things, or mainly that you don't lose your data, that you don't get your data corrupted. Everybody who has a computer science degree will know there are promises, GA atomicity. Either a transaction takes place completely or not at all. So it cannot happen that a transaction only takes place half, then a machine crashes or the network breaks down and the database ends up in state, which is not okay. Rules have to be followed, like an index has to be really unique, or you cannot delete that or change that or whatever. And those rules have to be obeyed so that the systems always move from one legal state to another legal state. The I comes from isolation, means that if several users or one user is making several transactions in parallel on the system, that the system guarantees that those transactions don't influence each other in a bad way. They can be executed one after each other or whatever the database wants to do, but it has to guarantee that there is no corruption taking place between those actions. And of course, the most important one is that nothing of the data gets lost. So there should always be a backup system that allows restoring the data that has been stored in the database up to the point where the failure occurred. So what does Prevailer do? The most provocative thing about it is probably the first item, and that is that every object is stored in memory. This could either be RAM, but of course if RAM is full, it could also be put into the swap space. But this is probably a statement that will hold of many people actually using such a system. But I've been thinking about it myself, and it is very, very big systems probably need to have a more clever disk-based data management system. That if you look at the applications that we are writing every day, or that a small or mid-sized business uses, it's pretty likely that all the objects will be found in memory at one time anyway. You might have a list view of all your objects in your database, and you have all the objects in some widget or whatever stored anyway, so it doesn't make sense if the database should be limited to not keep their objects in memory directly. And the way it guarantees those robustness goals is that it doesn't work with the current state of the objects that you have in your application, but it works with changes. So it's about incremental changes. Let's say there's the warehouse system and you want to increase all your prices by 10%. Then what will be stored is that there has been an action that every price has been increased by 10%. So there will not be a snapshot before and after that is stored, but only the diff between those two changes. And all those changes are locked, and they are locked by serializing the object that has triggered that change. So it's actually similar to the undo redo pattern, that you have a class that is there to execute an action, and that class also needs to have some way to persist itself to memory. There are ways to also store snapshots of all objects in memory on disk, but this is mostly an optimization, because what the prevailer system allows is that you, if you want to restart your database, or if you have to restart your database, you simply start with a minimal subset, basically no objects, and then go through all your locked changes and re-execute them again until you have reached the latest stand point again. This could, of course, if there have been millions of changes, then lead to some delays on the restart of the database, and that's why there's the mechanism of taking temporary snapshots, so that on a new startup, the last snapshot is reloaded and only the changes since that snapshot are executed again. I hope that everybody or many have already implemented some code using an redo undo pattern. And those people will, of course, know that it requires some discipline to do so. Meaning that also this system requires some discipline of how you manipulate your data. You have first to extract all the objects you have in your system, and then you also have to extract the manipulations you're doing on them. The short recipe to use the system is that you, of course, first design your model, how your application looks like, and then for each transaction that you have to have one class that will then later, upon a call of a virtual function, execute that transaction. Then you just create an instance of that database system and make sure to just execute all your transactions to the system. There are, of course, functions that will do that immediately for you. I have to mention a rather dangerous trap at that point, maybe, and that is that you have to be very careful with dealing with external resources here. Let's imagine that you do some changes in your data, and together with the changes you also do time calculations. Like you say at 12 p.m. I did that and that change, or you calculate how long an operation took by comparing one time with another time. This will horribly fail with the prevailer system, because it has to be able to re-execute all actions again. And this could, of course, happen on another day at another time. So storing times in such objects has to be done very carefully. And the way they have done it in their demo applications, and it's actually built to the system as well, is that there is a special clock object that you have to be using. And this clock is then later, upon replaying of the database transactions, already kept in the right states before this transaction is executed. Okay, let's show something practical now. Let's say those are items of the warehouse, and here very conveniently they just have to implement the serializable interface from the graph Java library. And this object now only contains three member variables. You see they can use the native types, and this system will, or the Java system will really take care of immediately serializing that object for you without any additional work that needs to be done by the programmer. Now a sample of a transaction. There's this base class transaction, and in this case I've done a sample implementation of the price increase action that I've mentioned before. And it starts out with the value of the price increase that has to be stored for later executions. This is the constructor for constructing this action, and this is the function that will be called by the system. There will be the reference passed to the system and also the date if you need that. And from here on you can of course call functions on other objects of your system or whatever you like. So this is really just a matter of writing code in your native language, and the system will take care of storing the objects for you or retrieving them if necessary. I looked at the list of ports to other languages that are available. Of course, there's the C# port and the other usual suspects. As usual, the quality varies a lot. There are those typical SourceForge projects that have never made a release so far and are still in the design phase. But I guess the C# one, I think that's the one we hear most about. It's probably also fully standard. And I've not checked them out. Notably, our favorite language, or most of us favorite language is missing, that is C++. And that's what made me think of how could we do something differently in our language that it fits in well. I looked at how Java does it, and it uses the JDO standard that has been done by Sun, and this standard for the Java data objects gives unified persistent interface. So the interface is predefined, but it's up to implementers to implement the actual database backend behind that. It can be compared to ODBC or the Java equivalent JDBC as having a unique interface for accessing all kinds of different databases and by hiding also the low-level details from the programmer. Supposedly you can interchange different implementations of the database. Don't know how well that works. So usually there will probably be some problems. You're also supposed to be able to switch between different paradigms, like having an object-oriented database behind that, or even just flat files. Because that everything is done behind the scenes. Their goal is to be minimal intrusive, but one thing they also do is to mandate a common base class that you derive off. So this is one point where they certainly break the principle of minimal intrusion. An example is here, and from here, first an instance of the persistent manager is created, and then Java objects are created. Functions are called, and at the end there's simply one call saying object please persist yourself. I think there's a syntax error in the last line. It's been very lean. And this is the way I would dream of being able to do database programming in C++ as well. I don't know how many share my vision, but I don't want to have to write any more code than can be seen. So I started to investigate how the same could be possible in C++, and the Prevailer documentation gives some help in a way for people wanting to do more code. They're saying that you of course need a serialization mechanism, and that's what's obviously missing in C++, so some work has to be done. To simplify things, I thought I'd limit myself to simple business objects containing nothing but some data members, references to each other, no GUI objects, no signals, no views, no redundant data, so the first possible objects first. The ways that I could think of to do the same in C++ are written below. And that would be, of course, just to have a base class having some virtual functions like save yourself, load yourself, create yourself, or streaming operators that then have to be manually implemented by each by programmer for each class. Could be done, but it is not very convenient. An alternative would be to use some macros or templates to help you with that task to get it done in a normal lines of code. Another idea that is done in other systems is maybe to use documentation tags to describe a class and use a documentation parser like KDOC or some of the derivatives of that to draw that information out of there, or do full processing of the code that has been written by the programmer, which requires a parser that understands all or almost all of C++, of course. Then there are approaches, as usual, to use an interface definition language, which I think has the problem that it's, again, not the same as C++, and will be another language, although very simple, and there will be surely some intermediate files and skeletons that have to be re-implementations again. But let's look at short pictures of how that can be done. I'll start with what that Russian guy did. He had the goal to not use a preprocessor, and he went through great pains to accomplish that goal. But he has come up with a pretty impressive system, Post++, that's an in-process storage mechanism that works on on the byte level by mapping objects inside of memory and storing them to disk directly. You can also have an optional garbage collection helping you with that, and it really works with almost everything that's there in C++, like multiple inheritance and pointers inside of objects, so the system is able to follow pointers and persist objects as well. One requirement for that is that the class has to have a default constructor. And that is because when deserializing an object from the store, in C++, the easiest way simply is, of course, to just create a default object and then, with setter functions, fill that object with the data that it had before again. Otherwise, you would have to have a specialized constructor for that, and the database system would have to have knowledge about all those constructors. And since C++ is such a static language, this cannot be done easily. An example, a class that has three members of different types. There's first a normal pointer, then an array, and the last one is actually an array that can have a variable length. This is just to demonstrate that those kinds of types can also be handled. So he puts a macro in each class that describes the information. First, it states the name of the class, and then there are some macros that says that next is a reference, that array is an array of references, and then child is a variable length reference. There is some more magic behind that, of course. I think it's going to be a templates that are behind that. But it works. All that he needs afterwards is to simply register that class, and the system is able to persist those objects. He has written a second system, which is then a real database. The other one was just an in-process storage system. And this database can even distribute its memory, its data to several machines, which are managed through a central server that knows where which data is stored. And the client just sends requests to the server, which answers to the data. What this system can do, which is actually very impressive, is that you can have access to objects through different versions of class definitions. Meaning that if you have a class A on one day, but add a member a day later, the system still allows you to access the objects through an older version of that class, and that is pretty vital when you do updates to your system. The system can also be, since that point is possible, it's also possible to really do online modifications to the database. The system is pretty generic and can therefore be theoretically run 7 days a week, 24 hours. the system uses to describe glasses is rather similar to this other solution. First, this is just about registering this class first. It says the class is named C and it derives from the class object. And then it's globally registered, and a locking scheme is also provided here, which is not so important right now. The way he describes the class is that this sample class, which has an integer and a complex structure, has a virtual function which returns a field descriptor reference, and this reference is built up again by macros. So it says there's a field and an array. So we re-implemented the com operator there. And it works with nested types, so you could have other members in here which have their own described components implementation again. So in that way there are no limits to the complexity of objects. What he recommends though is to use those predefined types for those types that could have different sizes in different systems. One example for definition language, this is the standardized one. And we can already see that it's of course similar to C++, but it isn't C++, so we of course need some extra tool to process that one. The idea of using documentation tags, I've rather done that freely, is to put one of those user macros in here, which adds some standard functions. Maybe it should also contain the name of the class. Maybe it should point the macros necessary. But then the important part is to put the information about what needs to be persisted and how into documentation tags. One could say that all members are persisted by default, but in this case, all members that are supposed to be persisted have the serialized tag here. And in this case, one could even say that static members should be serialized, which might not always be desirable. Would be possible to add extra attributes, like saying this member has to be ID, or add some other mid information, like a description of the field, which could later then be very well used in a GUI that wants to offer some help to the user when he edits their field. So then, now come the parts that I did myself so far, and that is that I chose two approaches. First, I wanted to try how far I could get without using the preprocessor myself. This system, for which I don't have a name yet, also requires a common base class, some macro defining the name of the class, adding some functions you can take a look in the editor later, like instantiating that object. Here's the constructor, which is also a default constructor, just some backup function for convenience. And what I've done here, it's not to use the native C++ types, but I've used my own custom types. And that's where the magic is actually hidden, that those types should behave like a string and it's like an integer, but there is some magic behind it that will help serializing the object. And then just a global registration for the class so that the system knows about this class and is able to restore objects of that class from this area. The sample implementation of one of those properties, this is the one for integers, has a default constructor, of course. The other one is mostly there for convenience, and I've re-implemented some operators to make this integer behave like an integer. This probably cannot be done fully, but at least for simple code it works if you have an int I with a capital I in the int and assign values to it or cast it to other values. So it feels almost natural, but I'm sure that in some cases, like overloads or so, there will be problems. Next to the simple types, it's of course also possible to have more complex types, like a reference to another object that I've done with IDs. Every object has an ID, and in this case, just the ID of that reference object is later stored. And it will be possible to equally implement lists or whatever it is doing. The limitations of that system will certainly, or are certainly, that there are problems with nested types. Imagine you put one of those objects into another object. I think the system will have some failures identifying the properties that belong to those objects. And by not using the native C++ types, there will of course be some runtime penalty working with those values. In my case, the runtime speed was not such a big issue at all. And I admit that I chose the format of XML for my experiments because it was simply the easiest to debug what got out of it and what I should read in again. And it was also meant as a safety measure that if one day my system horribly fails, that there is still some way to get to our important business data by importing it into measure databases. XML of course helps if the types are changed, but of course only if the types are extended. If a member is removed, the XML format will also not really help you with migrating it. And it has some efficiency problem, of course, as soon as the data start getting bigger. But I've seen that there are solutions for storing XML very, very efficient. So this might not be actually such a big issue. Java's implementation on JSX, and for example, SleepyCat software has an XML library as well that is built on their normal Berkeley DB, and it's a library that works in process and has a very, very high performance. I think that's something that one can easily trust from that company. And there are interfaces for C++ and Java, so that should be no problem to use. It's also supported on many platforms. The problem I mentioned earlier about upgrades is certainly a hard one. What happens if you have your system running just fine, but one day you decide that you have to add another field or remove one or change the class hierarchy, for example? That will probably be the most difficult one. Solutions for that are, of course, to manually go the tough way and write some conversion function that takes every object and stores it into another format. You could convert into another domain first. It's easier to manipulate XML if it's already there and just take some tool to convert into another format. Or what the Russian programmer did is to extract how you access the objects from C++. But that requires very, very low probably assembler access to how data is really stored if you have code in a C++ object. You have to remember that in C++ there will be space reserved for the virtual function table, etc. And getting that memory layout right will be hard. Let's see. Already getting closer to the end before I just show what I still have done, what I have managed to done with my prototype so far. Let's start with it. The prototype system first. Here are just two sample classes, which is the one of the customer I showed earlier, and here this one would be a collection of all clients that there are stored in the system. In this case I've just tested the reference here, but of course this class could also manage a list unless there is some convenient class that helps you to collect those. And to test this I just created two instances and streamed out the content of those objects into XML. So this is not very impressive, of course. It was enough for me to show that it will be possible, that it is possible to persist a C++ object that way. Reading it is done by first looking at the type, like customer or client field, and invoking a factory function, a static factory function on those classes, to create a default object, and then from the known properties that are in there, setting the values again. drawback is that we don't know the names of the members here. They're lost. So this, yeah?
So the order does matter in
yes.
the
and that's a certain weakness.
It's the killer.
Yeah. Even if, or if somebody inserts a member, the system will be go horribly out of sync. So I think it's okay for simple stuff, but it will not work out in the long run.
If you solve that, I think that is the missing component at this point.
Yeah.
The serialization methods.
Yeah. Yeah, I can show something what I did as an answer to that. And that's what I did in my little experiment on how to get this naked objects framework working in C++. It's a Java system. Again, maybe I'm getting a bit any on what they can do, but it's there's at least some desire to do some stuff they do, not only because they can do it, but because we are certainly lagging behind in some convenience. So this system, open source, there's written a book about it, nakedobjects.org. The book can either be purchased or downloaded from the net. And this topic would actually cover a whole talk, so I'll just summarize it in 4 or 5 points. The idea behind naked objects is to expose the business objects directly to the user. So there is no instance between the user and those objects, like in a model view controller system, where the controllers actually being the one that's delegating any steps that you do to the objects. So the classes are directly exposed, and the user is able to invoke any function on those objects and query data from that. The idea is that those objects, of course, have them to be behaviorally complete, so it must be possible to do everything that's needed from the object interface. So the idea is to empower the user, and therefore one could expect that without a programmer adapting the application all the time, the user is able to solve certain tasks by himself by combining objects with each other. Demo applications on the web, take a look. My time is running out, so I'll just show a simple prototype of that. And here I again have a C++ class for a customer and for a license. And the way the system is supposed to work according to those guys is that in the context menus, there are ways you can invoke functions. Of course, you can create new instances. You could call member functions. And here I have taken, I'd like to show it. The way the customer class is defined here is that it again derives from the base class. I've also used those special types here, although that might not need it. But the system works automatically. There is a member first name and a member last name, and what the system does is to convert those into descriptions of the fields. So the pure system really leaves no GUI programming to the application or the system program anymore. I think that will simply not work out so well. So I think if you want to have a real usable system, you will have to have a lot of virtual functions in those objects to also have the programmer have some influence on how the objects behave and how the GUI works. But this is really future planning, but I keep on working using such a system in my company before switching to some pre-made system or something else. Okay, by that I'll close my talk. Thank you very much.
Questions in the middle there. Yeah, please stand up and speak up because we don't have any microphones that we can pass along.
Will you ever release that stuff? Why did you deal with it?
Yeah, it's right now a mixture of too many stuff, but I would like to put something like that into the US. Not as a ready enterprise system, but just as a framework for people like us or consultants that can go in a company and implement their solutions in C++.
Did you think about simply extending the mock preprocessor to parse variables, and then you could have something that implements the serialization in the data stream or whatever?
Yeah, actually, what I thought of was using the system that you have been working on. Is it Smoke or?
Yeah, that's
like, because I only need the memory variables and to generate a little bit of code. The problem with mock is first, there's no way to instantiate objects. And I wanted to have members and not getter and setter functions.
Right.
So it could be possible, but it requires modifications as well. But my hope was actually in the old KDOC system, the way it's now, to extend it to some other stuff.
Yeah, it's from Calyptus now.
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay, maybe one more question. There is any? Really difficult to see for me when anybody raises this hand. Okay, so it seems there are no more questions. Yeah, thanks a lot, Harry.
Yeah, you can't.